This is an interview with Mrs. Rose Stricker Weed Thompson by Shirley Tanzer for the Beaverton Oral History Project. This is tape one, side one. The date is July 16th, 1982. The interview is being conducted in Mrs. Thompson's home, which is on Thurlow Road, off Walker Road.
1, 2, 3, testing, 1, 2, 3.
Rose, I'd like to ask you where your parents came from.
My parents came from Switzerland.
Where and when did they come
here? Well, they left Switzerland in 1914. My mother came from a beautiful village called Spiez, and my father was from a little village near the Austrian border in St. Gallen. So they came to, they went to Liverpool, and they got on a boat, ship, and they went to Halifax. And I was 9 months old. So in Halifax, they took the ship. No, they didn't take the ship. They'd already been on the ship. They took the immigrant train, which it went down through Chicago to Saskatchewan, which was about a two-week trip. And so we lived in Canada for about a year. We lived with a Swiss family by the name of Lutz. But my mother didn't like it there because it was so cold, and in the morning, like, she'd wake up and the baby diapers would be frozen to the floor. So about that time, we heard about the Swiss in Oregon. So in due time, we arrived in Boring, Gresham area.
How did you hear about the Swiss in Oregon?
Well, now that we don't know. My father was rather gregarious, and of course, that's the way it was. You know, when the Italians left, they would go where there were other Italians. And when the Norwegians left, or the Finnish, they would go, like, to the ocean and always try to be where there were other people of their nationality so they could help each other out. Not only that, but they had the same language and the same interests. I think it was sort of a thing of having someone to depend on.
Who did they come to in Oregon?
I was thinking through my father's papers the other day. Now, he left 1915 from Canada, and he came to a man by the name of Mr. Jervis, and he came in as farm laborer. And I think maybe at that time there was a need for that, because he had several skills, and he had five languages, and so did my mother. But I think that's the way they came in, because that was probably what they needed at that time in Idaho. He came through Idaho, through Sand Point.
Did he stop there before he got to Oregon?
Yes, he went to he went to Coeur d'Alene. He was there for a number of months. Then we were in Spokane for a number of months, and that wasn't right. So the reason he came to Boring was because there was a man by the name of Gantenbein, Chris Gantenbein, who had been his child friend. They'd known each other since they were 3-4 years old and had gone all the way through school, and somewhere or other they'd kept in touch with each other. So he lived across the road from Chris Gantenbein for a year. And then, of course, the First World War came along. And then he went to live near the other brother, who was also from the same village of in St. Gallen, which is a rather large canton, the little village of Grops. And so he lived there, and during the war, he worked for a cookie factory.
Now, just a minute, let me ask you. You said the other brother. Whose brother was there?
The other Gantenbein brother.
I see.
So there was a Hans and there was a Chris.
Now, are we still in Boring?
Yes, we've just left Boring and we've gone to Gresham.
Mm-hmm. And the cookie factory?
Was in Portland, and of course, I don't know whether he called it that because it was a fun name for his three little daughters, but I know at night he always came home with little fat chocolate eclairs in his pocket. And but he always said never to eat ginger snaps, because that's where all the old dough went, you see. So I've never... Oh, and you brought me ginger snaps.
I brought you ginger snaps.
I'll give them to my husband.
How appropriate. Let me ask you something else, though. You mentioned that he had a number of skills. What were they?
Well, he had, from his particular town, Grops, G-A-R-B-S, they have very large looms. And these looms, I've been there, and these are rooms that they build onto these houses, and they have very large rooms where they do embroidery. And it's a machine embroidery. In other words, my father would sit at the end, And like a typewriter, he would do this, and there would be maybe 300 handkerchiefs embroidered at a time, and do a tremendous amount of Madeira type of embroidery. So when he went to London in 1910 to learn English, this is what he did when he was living in London, learning the English language. And then he'd also been an apprentice to a shoemaker for a couple of years. And so he knew about repairing shoes. And at that time, he wasn't making them. That wasn't what he learned. He learned that. And of course, his languages at that time, he thought, would do him a lot of good, which they never did, of course.
Well, how many languages? You said, what languages were
it? He spoke German, the dialect, Swiss dialect, French, Italian, English, and some Romance, which is the old Latin tongue that's spoken around St. Moritz.
How did he come to this area?
Oh, to Beaverton, 1921. Well, after the World War was over, and I remember very well sitting on the fence, and the boys, the young men were coming by with their broad-brimmed hats, and I was waving the flag. About that time, he went to work in Mount Angel. And we were not Catholic, but we were Swiss. And the Mount Angel College had been formed by the Swiss from Engelberg, the Catholic fathers from Engelberg. So we went to work there for a year. And my father did the farm work. We had a house, and we had free milk and free eggs. And then I had a little sister that died. And, of course, we never knew why or how, but she was buried there, and my father was very crushed by this. So then he left there and went to rented the Talbot Farm. As you go down the highway, you see Talbot Road. He was one of the old pioneers in and around Jefferson. So we lived there for about a year, and he had many cows and horses. But he had never really had a farm background, so he really didn't do that well. There were many problems, too, so he left there. And from there, he went to another Swiss community of Rock Creek. We rented a house from a Swiss by the name of Caratley, and that worked very well until the well went dry. And then, of course, there was no water for the cows or for his family. And then about that time, he came to Bethany, which, of course, is a Swiss-German community. And we lived right near the German Baptist Church. At that time, the churches out there all preached in German. And we rented a farm, not from a Swiss, but from a man by the name of Kyle, K-Y-L-E. And I've often wondered that would be any connection with the Kyles who came to Aurora so many years ago. But we lived there for about 15 years, 21 acres, rented $100 a year. And doesn't sound like much money now, but when you're raising five children, depression, and you have a few cows to you'd save the check from selling the milk. And of course, we had 50 pear trees and we had cherry trees, so beautiful vegetable gardens. So it really wasn't a very good place for my parents, because we should have been on the edge of a small town, because my father was quite gregarious, and he liked to talk politics, and there really wasn't ever anyone to talk with. And was very pretty and gentle, and so life really wasn't that easy for them.
What were his interests aside from his farming?
Well, he was crazy about his five little girls. He thought that was just about as good as it could be. Well, he sang. He had been singing in Switzerland, and he was considered quite a good yodeler, so people used to come to the house and hear him yodel. And he would sing his children to sleep every night in some foreign language. Brahms' Lullaby, I remember. Santa Lucia, I remember. What else did he do? Oh, then he got to mending shoes for the farmers in the wintertime. And then in the wintertime, we didn't have much to do. He decided he was going to become a peddler. So instead of being a Watkins peddler, he got a firm that was called Koch, K-O-C-H, which means cook. So he would go all over Helvetia and Beaverton, West Union, and he would sell vanilla and some of these products, also a product called cow care, which kept the cows from aborting. And so he would pedal all over the area for many miles, and once in a while I would skip school and I would go with Papa. And on those days, he always sold more, because his idea was to leave the suitcase in the car because the lady knew what he wanted. And I said, oh no, Papa, you have to bring it in, because when she sees it, she'll probably buy something that she didn't know she needed. So we always had a good time with him.
You were the oldest of the family.
I was the oldest, and I understand that the oldest daughter in the family is a lucky one.
Well, now tell me who the others in the family are, so we get the...
Yes, I'm Rosa Clara, and then I have a sister, Ursula Hildegard, and I have a sister, Mary Elizabeth, and I have a sister, Emma. I don't think she ever had a middle name. And then there was a brother, Andrew Walter. Andrew was my father's name, and Walter was a very fine Swiss name, and is still a very popular name. They name their boys Walter.
Are the rest of the family in this area as well?
I have a sister who lives in California. She's been there for about 30 years. She likes the sun. And then my brother is in California. We don't exactly know where he is, but he does a lot of Western singing, and he thinks that's a lot of fun.
So the other sisters are here?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Em and Betty are here, and we talk on the phone. We don't see a lot of each other, but we keep in touch.
Well, do you consider the home to be Bethany, or what particular area?
Yes, I would say Bethany, but I found it very interesting that there doesn't seem to be a beginning place for Bethany or an ending place. At one time there was a grocery store there, and even today when I go over there I can't quite figure out where it begins and where it ends, and where the name came from, I don't know. And people seem to always know where Cedar Mills is, but Bethany is just something out there somewhere.
Did you go to school in Bethany?
Yes, I did. I went to a school. It was called District Number 6, and it's on 143rd Street, and the back is a Union Cemetery where my parents are buried. And in the front at that time, there was a large two-bedroom schoolhouse with a hall down the center. And, of course, down at the end, they had the big crock for the water and the single ladle that we all drank out of, and the little lunch boxes on the side. And I remember going to school, one of the things I thought was kind of fun was that, of course, in those days, everybody baked homemade bread. So mother had a little arthritis, so she a lot of these things that she didn't do or couldn't do or didn't want to do. So Papa would go over to Davidson's Bakery, and he would buy bread that was a day old. He used to call it secondhand bread. He thought that was real funny. He got a big bag for 50 cents. And then I'd have store-bought sandwiches. Well, the kids in school had never seen store-bought bread. So we would trade sandwiches, which was a lot of fun. I ended up with a good homemade bread. And then on days we didn't have any bread, well, Mama would make little pancakes for me to go take to school with jelly on the inside. And I used to be so embarrassed because I was eating pancakes when everybody else was eating bread. I used to kind of hide around the corner so they wouldn't see my pancakes.
Where was junior and senior high school?
I have to tell you something else that happened in the fourth grade that was so much fun. My mother decided I should have hot milk for lunch. So every morning about 11 o'clock, I would have to climb up some little stairs, and there was a little humidifier on the inside of this large metal coating. Not quite the name of it, but anyway, I had to climb up on this little stool in front of all these children, and I'd put my half pint of cold milk in it, so about the time it was lunchtime, I would have hot milk. And I did that for a while until I guess I finally talked my mother out of it, because the other kids didn't have to do that.
Why did she decide that you needed
Well, yes, you know, cold outside, and she thought it was good for me.
Was this related to the death of your younger sister?
No, I don't think so. It was just little extra tender loving care. And one of the funny things that I thought was really funny is that she used to make me leggings to wear in the winter time, like the soldiers did in World War I, and I'd wrap them around my legs. You see, I had to walk 3 miles to school, and sometimes it's very wet and very cold, and I'd get about halfway to school and I'd look behind and these leggings were dragging around in the mud or in the rain. So I don't know how long that lasted. And of course I had the long black stockings and the high top shoes and the braids. So I really liked school. You were asking about high school. In the eighth grade, I had a teacher by the Mrs. Armstrong, and there were three girls and four boys. And I figured I was just a very average student. I mean, being first generation, why, I didn't feel quite as comfortable, I suppose, as if I had been second generation, which a lot of the people were. But Mrs. Armstrong took me aside one day, and she said, "Now, Rose, you go home and tell Papa you have to go to high school." Because in those days, there wasn't a bus to Beaverton, and you either went to Beaverton to live, or you went by horseback. So I went home and told Papa that my teacher said I'm supposed to go to high school. So Papa thought that was a good idea, but I'd certainly have to find a school where I'd learn to cook and sew. So about that time, I looked and asked and found a school in Portland that was called Girls Polytechnic. And this was up on 14th and Morrison, and had been the original Portland High School for a number of years. And it was Gothic architecture. It was a very interesting building. And then it became Lincoln High School. So it had been Lincoln High School for a number of years. And about the time I went there, it was Girls Polytechnic. It was a two-year high school. And it was very interesting because the whole main floor was one big hall, and the rooms were around on the side. And then a stairway, you'd go up the stairway. And that was open too, and then the rooms were all upstairs. Well, we spent 1 year there, and about that time it was sold, of course, and today it's a parking lot. I don't know how many people would remember the old building, but it was very interesting. It was brown, it had tall steeples. It was very, very nice.
So you did not go to school in Beaverton?
No, and every once in a while they will have a end of the year, what they call a reunion or whatever. And I have a friend, Ruth Paisley. She'll say, "Now, Rose, the next time we have a reunion, because you come." And I said, "Well, I didn't graduate from there." And she said, "Well, that's all right." She says, "You know everybody." And that I did not go to Beaverton, no.
Did any of your sisters go to school in Beaverton?
Yes, both Betty and Emmy did. And Betty was very beautiful. And she was chosen for the prettiest in her graduating class, and her pictures went to Hollywood, and she was kind of the Linda Darnell type with the big eyes and the small waistline and the nice bosom and very friendly and nice.
Now, which one is she in line?
She is third down.
Oh.
Mary Elizabeth, or we call her Betty today, or Betts, or, you know, something.
Rose, tell me, how much time did you spend in Beaverton?
Well, I've actually never lived in Beaverton, but in the Bethany area.
Well, did your father trade, work in Beaverton, sell produce there? Or?
No, he never did that. He would sell. What he did, he had these gorgeous Bartlett pear trees, and at that time he contracted his cherries also and his pears to a firm. It was either Hillsborough or Forest Groves. It was called Ray Mailing. And they would promise that they would take your produce. And then there was a year where he cleared 2 acres of land by himself, which was quite a feat, with a couple of horses and dynamite. And then he went to Portland, and I would go in with him, and would go down and buy pipe from the secondhand men down on 1st and 2nd Street, and he put in his own irrigation system alone. And then he decided to grow cucumbers. So he had 2 acres of cucumbers. And the cucumbers were supposed to be only a length of about 3 inches because they were used for pickles. And Ray Mailing also took those. And of course, if they were 4 inches, why, they were too big. And that was kind of sad because it was an awful lot of work for the amount of money. At that time, I was going to high school in Portland, so I didn't get in on all the backbreaking work. But
was the family expected to help, and in what ways?
Well, yes. I don't know. I always thought Papa was a little different. He always thought the children should have a good time. However, in my last year at grammar school, there was a janitor job, and they never before had a lady janitor. So I decided I would be able to build the fires and the two stoves, and I would be able to sweep the rooms at night. So Papa would walk to school with me one day a week and chop the kindling. And so I could start the fires, which was really a big job because I really wasn't very good at it. The rooms were kind of smoky. So at the end of the month, I would get $5, and I would give that to Papa. So then about the time I went to high school, I lived with a family and worked for board and room for 3 years, $5 a month. And $2 of that went for car fare. And I used to go down to Olson King's basement and buy cotton Lyle stockings for 25 cents a pair and wear them with my heavy brogues that I shine beautifully. And so finally, at that time, I'd also gone to work at Meyer and Frank, but...
Who was the family with whom you lived, Rose?
Shanks. Her father, Mrs. Walter Shanks. Her husband had been a congressman at that time. However, they were English, and I thought they were a very cold family. I never could understand the family relationship because no one seemed to be very loving or demonstrative, and I always felt sort of a chill through the house because I'd come from a different kind of a family. But I learned to set the table properly and a few other things that were useful.
What were your other responsibilities?
Oh, I did everything. I got up in the morning and cleaned the whole downstairs and fed the child and washed the dishes and made my bed and left for school at 7:45 in the morning. Then on Saturdays I would do clean the whole house and do the washing. And then during the week I'd do the ironing in the evening, $5 a month. Well, I didn't mind that, except the girls down the street were getting $10 a month.
Oh.
She was nice in her way, and of course, Papa, the day he brought me, he cried, and she promised to take very good care of me. So when I started dating, well, the young man could come at 8 o'clock, but he had to take me back by 11, and we sat on those up in Willamette Heights up there off of 33rd and Thurman. We would get on one of these long streetcars, and we'd sit there. And we'd go to the movie up on Broadway. Then we'd stop at the Crazy Cat, which was on 6th Street. And we would have a tuna fish sandwich and chocolate milkshake, which came at 25 cents. And then he had to be home. I had to be home by 11 o'clock. So it was very interesting. But finally, I left. And it was kind of a difficult thing to leave. And I still don't remember how I did it, because this time I was 17. And I was working at Meyer and Frank, which didn't pay very much. So I ran an ad in the paper. Now, whether I put my own phone number in it or a box, this business girl wants to work for room and board. And I didn't want to tell her I was leaving. So an afternoon at 4 o'clock, a taxi came to get me, and I was leaving. She said, "Why didn't you tell me you were leaving?" And I said, "Well, I was afraid you wouldn't like it." So we both cried and said goodbye, and I climbed in the taxi. But I've kept touch with her through the years, and she finally died a few years ago out here at the nursing home. So I always thought she did the best she could, you know.
Have you been in touch with the children at all? Family?
Yes, there is a son in the area and a daughter who lives in Eastern Oregon, but that was a lot of years ago, like in the 20s.
Did you continue living in Portland?
Well, see, I'd gone to work for Meyer and Frank, and so then that was kind of interesting. I worked on the Dairy Lunch, which at that time was on the 9th floor, and it had high stools. And at that time, there were 25-cent lunches. There were little, very nice little sandwiches and coffee and a dessert for 25 cents. And I remember my very first job, I'd come to work, and the girl said to me, the girl in charge, she said, "I hope you're wearing a petticoat." And I said, "Well, of course I wear a petticoat. I always wear a petticoat." And she said, "You know, you must wear a hairnet, too." So she sat me on a high stool, and she says, "Now, you must learn to butter bread." So it was a sandwich bread, and there was a real trick to having the butter just right and getting the butter all the way around to the edge, you see. So I learned how to do that, and I really got very good at it. But anyway, the big thing was that one day we were supposed to sell strawberry shortcake, which was 20. They had a lot of strawberries, you see, and you're supposed to sell the shortcake for 25 cents, and the coffee was a nickel. And so I was considered a pretty good sales lady because I sold more shortcakes than anybody else. And then they put me in the bakery, and then I got fat because I started eating all those Danish rolls, which were only a nickel with jam centers. And then they put me in the delicatessen, and I worked for a very fine man by the name of Mr. Bettelheim. And I worked there for a year, and the people would line up at 5 o'clock, and they have Rosie wait on them. You know, I guess I was nice to them. So about that time, I decided I wanted to go back to high school because I'd only had the 2 years. And I went to Grant High School. I'm very bad in math, but I was in... I took the history and the English and always made the honor grades, so in due time I left there. There's everybody in Portland my age has worked at Meyer and Frank at one time or another.
Did you graduate from Grant High?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So anyway, one of the things I did, I wanted to work on the elevators at Meyer and Frank. And at that time they were putting in those gorgeous new elevators which banked Morrison and Alder. And the girls were really attractive, and they had to be just so tall and small waistlines. So, and the uniforms were made for us, and they had a little slim little navy silk skirts with matching little vests and pretty little white blouses. So after about 2 months of this, I thought this was about the dumbest job. Why just work on an elevator when I could be learning or doing something? So I tried to get off the elevator, but they said, well, that's where you want it to be. So anyway, they had a woman in the tea room, and she was kind of plump, and every time she got on the elevator, she wouldn't pay any attention to the operators. Her back would face the door. And he'd always say, please face the door, and she never would face the door. So one day I was leaving the main floor, and she decided to get out. And so about the time she got out, my elevator doors hit her and threw her out on the floor. And the vice president of Myron Frank Company was there and saw the accident. And she had this terrible reputation, you see. So anyway, I got off the elevators, and the woman really wasn't hurt, and she tried to sue the company and so forth. So anyway, finally I went up to see Mr. Kernan, and I said, I've got to have another job. You've got to find me a place. And he said, you don't like Myron Frank very well. And I said, no, I really don't. And of course, at that time, it was depression. There were 100 girls waiting for my job. So he said, well, I guess you don't have to work here anymore. And I said, fine. So I thought that was very courageous. And I went up the street, and 2 hours later, I had a job at the Orange Lantern Tea Room. And this was 10th and Alder, and there were
now
two.
What was it called?
The Orange Lantern Tea Room. And it was in the central building, and it was on the third floor. And Young's Gown Shop was downstairs. I used to go in there, and there was a real nice lady that used to spray me with French perfume, and I thought that was very nice. Anyway, I worked at the Orange Lantern Tea Room for a few months, and I was making $1.50 a day. And the girls were all really nice girls. Some of them were teachers and nurses. We just couldn't find jobs anyplace else. And it was very attractive. It was in yellow and greens. And it was during the Depression, and you'd get a lunch for 25 cents. And people would be lined up to the street. And the suppers were 35 cents. And these women were so funny. There were two old maids. And one was Margaret, and she had the large, bushy hair and about three cats. And she'd scream and yell at people. And the other sister was a rather large woman, kind of squarish, built with teeth that didn't fit very well. And she would always go out there and talk to all the men, and she'd kind of bounce as she'd talk to them. Well, anyway, I did that for a while, and so I decided I certainly wasn't going to do that the rest of my life. And I knew that I wouldn't go to college because I'd had trouble with math at Grant High School. So anyway, besides, my mother had just gotten electricity, and I took what money I saved and bought her a Maytag washing machine, and she just thought that was, she didn't think it was hers, it was delivered, you know, like today, and she said, well, I didn't order a washing machine, but anyway, so I decided I should develop a skill. So at that time, Liebes had left Portland, and Mr. Ungar came in, and he was a Hungarian, and a very fine man in furs, and I thought, well, that looks like a really pretty store, they have pretty things in there, I think I'd like to sell there. So I went down, I remember, in a white skirt and a brown blouse, and no stockings, and no gloves, and no hat. So he didn't give me a job because he figured, you know, I looked like a country bumpkin, which I was. And so then he said, no, I couldn't give me a job. So anyway, about a week later, I'd seen this young man in the store, and I thought he must be one of the warehouse people, and I went over to him and I said, excuse me, but I'd seen you in the store. I said, you know, I want very much to work for Mr. Ungar. I said, I think it's such a pretty store. He said, well, I'm the superintendent. He says, you come in tomorrow. So he gave me a job, and Mr. Ungar was in New York. When he came back, he screamed, who hired that woman? So there were seven women that were hired for Christmas, and I was the only one they kept. But before this, I had had an appointment with Mrs. Fred Meyer, and she was going to put me in charge of the bakery down on 6th Street. And the women heard about it, so they called up Mrs. Fred Meyer, and they said, oh, you're proselyting our help, you know. So I lost that job. So, of course, when I'm working at Unger's, I keep looking at the front door to see whether these women, you know, will arrive. So they did come one day, but I hid in the lingerie dressing room.
Now, which women are you talking
about? These Ryan women that own the Orange Lantern, see.
Oh, I see.
Because, you see, they had quite a lot of control in those days, you see. But they did come in the door, and I hid in the lingerie dressing room, and I hid there until they left.
You mean they would have had the ability
to? They might have at that.
Who were they?
Well, they were just a couple of, well, Margaret was very clever and made a lot of money and had a very pretty tea room. And I don't know, but she called Mrs. Fred Meyer, and she said, "You're proselyting my help." She says, "Don't you come and take my help away from me." Now so Mrs. Fred Meyer did not hire me.
So their name was Ryan?
R-Y-A-N.
And they were sisters?
Uh-huh. They were really a little odd. I still have a friend that I knew at that time. She lives down at Woodburn, so we get together once in a while and talk about Mary and Margaret Ryan. They were so funny.
Now, did you go back to Beaverton or Bethany on the weekend?
I must tell you, in the tea room there, I guess I was kind of fast and I was long-legged. So Mary used to call me the Galloping Goose, mm-hmm. which I thought was awful funny. Did I come back to Beaverton? No, I never went back to the farm again. At that time, Pop had moved and had bought a place on the Bertha Beaverton Highway.
Where was it, Rose?
It was right where the unfinished furniture is. And it was a small house. It was one bedroom, an acre of land, and a barn. And it was $1,800.
No, was that on Kennedy?
This is a continuation of an interview with Rose Stricker Weed Thompson by Shirley Tanzer for the Beaverton Oral History Project. The date is July 16, 1982. This is tape one, side two.
Rose, did your father buy this from Mr. Kennedy?
Well, actually, I bought it. I remember he came to me one day and he said, "You know, Mama's been in the United States for a lot of years, and Mama deserves a house, but I don't have any money." By this time, he'd left the farm. And it was an acre of land and a barn and a very tidy little white house with one bedroom for sale for $1,800. And I said, "Well, it's not enough room." He said, "Well, I'll build on two rooms, and I want you to come home to live, and I want Ursula to come home to live so I can have my daughters around me for a few years." So he said, "Can you spare $15 a month?" He said, "I can do this if you can give me $15 a month." So for about 4 or 5 years, regardless of where I lived, the $15 a month took care of the payment. And so we held on to the house for many years, not many years, I should say, 6-7 years, and of course the property finally sold for $100,000.
Really?
It was 40 years later. But at that time, you see, his thinking was, Canyon Road was not a main arterial at that time, and because people were going in Cornell and Barnes, and he thought that the Bertha Beaverton Highway would be the main business road, and that was why he bought there. But of course, Canyon Road went first as far as business.
Did he farm there?
No, he didn't do too much. He had the cow, and we had several goats, and we had a vegetable garden, and he just loved to do yard work. So he had a hoe and a shovel, and he would go around the neighborhood and help people. In fact, the morning that he was killed by the automobile was 7 o'clock in the morning. He was going to help a neighbor with his gardening, and some girl who'd been driving all night didn't see him on the road and hit him and killed him.
Was it early, so early in the morning?
It wasn't that early, but I think she was confused. She'd been driving all night, and she was with her mother, and they were going on to Hillsboro, and I was living in San Francisco at that time, and it was a very sad thing to happen because the children were still in high school.
How old was he?
Only 60. Mm. But, of course, when the insurance money was to come through, they had all kinds of things. They said, "Well, after all, your father was working, he was old, and, you know, you shouldn't get the $10,000. So my mother only ended up with about $1,200, which was terribly unfair. Mm.
You did not move back to the farm then?
No, we never moved back to the farm. The horses died, and he cried because they were just, and then he sold the cows. And mother was getting quite arthritic, and the children were, you know, on their way. And
but you and Ursula did not move back?
No, we did go to the place on the Bertha Beaverton Highway, and we stayed there for a short time. Of course, we were used to a lot more freedom, so it was about that time I decided to go to San Francisco. And Papa cried because he didn't want me to go, and Mama kept saying, "Well, Papa, when you were a young man, you know, you left home too."
Why did you go to San Francisco?
Well, at that time, there were a lot of young people. This was in 1936. A lot of young people going to San Francisco. They thought Portland was kind of a cow town. There wasn't much doing in San Francisco where everything was. A lot of them went down, and very few of them actually came back. And I came back because of my father being dead and my mother being arthritic, and I was the oldest, I felt I should, you know, be there. But my father, he had lived in France, and he'd seen the big cities, and he said, well, you're going to get caught up in white slavery. So he just knew something bad was going to happen to me.
So what were the admonitions that you received before you left?
Well, the thing was that I was going to a big city, and I would certainly have to be careful. So I promised them that I wouldn't go out after 6 o'clock at night by myself. So consequently, I did an awful lot of staying home until I acquired a boyfriend or two. And then things seemed to be better. And then, of course, I did finally come home and never went back to live.
What were the reasons that you came home, aside from the fact that your father had died?
I guess maybe I'd never really planned to be gone that long. I just wanted the taste of the big city. I just couldn't imagine living in California. I wanted to get married and have lots of children. I didn't want to rear them in California at that time because I felt Portland was a better place to rear children. This was way back in 36, 37, I thought about that. And then the young man that I married, why, he was with the McCann Erickson Advertising Agency, and he really did not like Portland. He had gone to school in Portland and University of Oregon, but he did come back. And it's kind of difficult for him to give up California, which he loved and which he later went back to. But I just...
So did you come back after being married to him, Rose?
Yes, we'd been married just a number of weeks. And so I said, well, I really want to go to Portland. And he said, well, if I can get a transfer, we will go there. So we came back in 38. We were married in 38.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you live here with him?
We had an apartment down on 13th and Sam at the Shelston Apartments, and I was working with a girl, Nina, at Ungar's, and she said, I have a very cute house out in Lake Oswego, and I will my husband and I are separating, and I will sell you all my furniture, refrigerator, four-poster bed, curtains, a rug, dining set, lovely Davenport chair, a huge mirror, we can have it all for $200. Well, of course, we didn't have $200, but we bought it anyway. You know, you pay off $35. So anyway, I still, after all these years, I still have the mirror, which hangs over my bed. That's about the only thing that's left. But it was a good idea.
And how about your mother and the family on Bertha Beaverton Highway? How?
Well, after Papa died, we sold the place and we rented a house Irvington area, so they would be close to the high school. And we rented a kind of a nice house, older house, had been completely painted, $25 a month. And we lived in that for a number of years until the war came along. And Mama said, we've got to buy a house. So we looked all over Portland and finally said, why don't we buy this house? At least we know what's wrong with this house. So we did buy it.
Now, who's the we you're talking?
We, Mama. Well, see, mother was mother, and I was still the oldest, even though I was married, while I was in there making decisions and helping the younger children, trying to, you know, make it a little easier for them than it had been for me.
So who was still at home?
Well, they were all at home until the war, of course, and Ursula went to work for the engineers in Alaska. Betty and Emmy went to weld at Swan Island, and my brother joined the Air Force. But my brother had been gone about a year, and of course the girls were getting married, and mother was very arthritic at that time. She couldn't walk anymore. So she decided that her son had given a year to the Air Force, and so she wanted him home. So she wrote a letter to someone in Washington, D.C., and she said, I want my son home. I'm arthritic, and I think he's been in the service long enough. And she got him out of the service, and he came home and, you know, took care of her. So I think I always admire my mother because she seemed to get things done. She figured a year was, you know, enough.
Now, when was the property on Bertha Beaverton Highway sold, really?
Probably about 45, mm-hmm. And I think we made $2,000-$3,000 on it at that time, at the most. Mm-hmm. But there's still a big tree over there on the highway that my father planted.
Oh.
It's that big, and you'll see it sometime when you go by. It's a big.
Do pine tree. Do you remember the Kennedys or any of the families that lived in there?
I remember the old gentleman. Of course, at that time he was very old. He must have been 60, maybe 70. But anyway, he was sort of a nice old man. I don't remember having much conversation. I don't remember that there was any problem. We just brought him his $15 every month. And I don't even remember when the house came down or anything about it. On the other side, we had an interesting neighbor at that time. His name was, still is, I don't think he's alive, his name was Webb. And he was the English teacher at Beaverton High School. And he was teaching public speaking and at the high school, which was one of the things he taught. And he had many state winners. His name was Webb. Nice family.
Do you remember anything else about the area, about the political setup in the area?
No, I remember my father being very upset when Mr. Harding died, and of course he would, no, I guess maybe at that time I wasn't that interested. I remember the man I later married, Thurlow Weed, was running for U.S. Senator on a short term, 6 weeks, or I forget what it was, but he did run for U.S. Senator in the 20s, a long time ago.
How did you meet Thurlow?
Really funny. Well, I was working downtown at Ungar's, and I loved to go dancing.
Now, you were working at Ungar's after you came back from San Francisco?
Yes, I went back to Ungar's.
Oh.
And I worked for Evelyn Gibson. And Evelyn Gibson was very, very nice to me, and she taught me a lot about selling, and even to this day, I pop in once in a while to see her because I think she's a fine lady. But anyway, by this time, the war had come, and Bob Leeming, who was the nephew of the Jensen Knitting Mills family and a very fine, attractive man, we just had problems. I mean, he was working at night, and the baby was bothering him. He didn't get any sleep. And
oh, now this is your first husband.
That was Bob Leeming, yes, Ron's father. And I think if it hadn't been for the war, we would never have gotten divorced. But everything seemed to go wrong during the war. I wanted to weld at the shipyards, and he didn't want me to work. And yet there wasn't enough money. And so one day I just decided I'd take my baby and go live with mother because I just couldn't figure it out. And of course, in those days, I had no counselors. You either went to the minister or the doctor, and they helped you solve your problems. And if they weren't there or if your parents couldn't help you, why, you just, you know, you didn't have professional help like you have today. So anyway, I'd been single there for a while. No, I had met, this was years ago. See, I met Bob when I was 19, and I was 19, and I had heard that the young men who were going to law school, Northwestern Law School, where Dean Bryson went and John Gantenbein, and Thursday nights they would all go up to the Uptown Ballroom to dance. So I thought, well, it might be interesting to marry a lawyer because I understood they made money and they were kind of nice people. So I went up on Thursday nights. This was way back when I was 19, and I met Thurlow Weed. And we played tennis together and went to the movie. And years later, well, it was about 12 years later before we married, I said, how come we didn't get married when we first met? He says, because you had short hair and you were a lousy tennis player.
So you did not see him again for 12 years?
No, during the war, when I was welding at the shipyard, I was single, and I was looking down the street or up the street, and here came this handsome man with Captain Bars on his shoulder, and I thought, well, he's very attractive. I wish I knew him. So as I went by, he says, well, hello, Rose, how are you? And it was someone that I'd out of my past. So we had, of course, he had gas tickets for his car, so we went out to Ford's to eat. And he had a couple of dates. He'd never married. He was 37 at that time. So about our third date, he wanted to know if I'd get married to him. And I said, get married? I said, I've got a baby to take care of, and I've got a good job, and I've got to take care of Mama. So anyway, a couple of days later, I liked the way he said. He said, well, the war won't last forever, and your baby needs a father. Besides, you'd probably like to be the wife of an officer back in Kansas, and you'd probably have a good time, and I'll take care of you, and if you want me to adopt the baby, I will. So I thought, well, that sounds pretty nice. He said, I've got a ring for you. So I accepted the ring, but I wasn't quite divorced from my other husband, so. And I was just still really in love with Bob. So as soon as Thurlow left, I called up Bob and I said, well, what about us? And he said, well, it won't work. So then I made the decision, and 2 months later we were married in Kansas in a little army chapel. Lived there for a year, which was very unusual. Had a little red-haired daughter. Came home, 46 with two babies. Ron was a little wild when he was all over the train. We did have a compartment. And the little red-haired baby was 6 weeks old, and every time she went and had a bottle, it came up. And so anyway, we went to Denver, and they had the USO homes there where you could take your babies and bathe them and give them fresh milk. My brother was there, and we came into Portland, and we had to wait for about 6 months for Thurlow to come home because he was supposed to go to Okinawa. But in all this time in the service, he had written 700 original jokes, which I still have, which have never been published. So anyway, he put them together after the war, and then in 46 we moved in little brown cottages, which you remember.
Yes. Now, tell me, when you came back to Portland, who did you come back to when you came back?
My mother was there, you see. She still had this house, and someone had to be with her. So I had the two babies, and so always very seemed to be taking care of mother. She was always around. We always enjoyed being together.
Now, what about Thurlow's family?
Thurlow Howard Weed had been doctor of entomology at the age of 19 down in Louisiana, and he'd had two children. And at the birth of the last child, the wife had died in childbirth. So he went to Chicago, where he married Mark and Simpson, who had just come over from Belfast. So they came out here, and he was to work for Riverview Cemetery, but it didn't work out, so he came to Beaverton and bought the 25 acres. And the baby was at that time 3 years old, who was Thurlow Weed, my husband, and came here and had the 25 acres of iris for many years. And then Margaret died during the war, so maybe Thurlow felt free to marry too, you see. I think he and his mother had quite a relationship because there wasn't very much companionship there, the way I understand it. So
he and his stepmother, Margaret, or he and his...
That was his real mother, but she had died during the war.
I see.
So the old gentleman married again, a very nice woman by the name of Edna. So they lived in the house.
In this house.
During the war, and then the old gentleman died. So after the death of the old gentleman, Edna took the bulbs, or the rhizomes, most of them that grew on the property here, and took them out to Cooper Mountain and went into the iris business there for a short time. So it was that time that Thurlow and Ron and Bonnie and I moved into this house.
But when had you lived in the cabin?
Oh, it wasn't a log cabin. It was just a little brown house. I'd lived there. After Thurlow came home, he did not go to Okinawa as the Air Force had planned, so we lived there for a number of months. And I really didn't want to come into a big house because I thought, my goodness, it's so much work and windows to wash. I'd really never lived in a big house. But I must say it's been a wonderful house, and it isn't that big anymore.
But Thurlow was very much involved in the Beaverton area.
Yes, it was very, very natural for him, very easy for him.
Had his father been involved in this area?
No. Well, he was quite a busy Rotarian, and his mother had been president of the Women of Rotary for the state. The father used to do some public speaking as far as, I think, I don't know what he talked about, iris or what was his interest. I know he was very interested in spiritualism.
Thurlow's father?
Howard, yeah. So I don't know whatever came out of that. I never knew him. I just knew that I lived in the little house, and he was out there picking up branches, and I thought, gee, those little branches. And I thought, gosh, he doesn't have much to do, but I find myself doing the same thing these days, running around picking up little branches to keep the yard looking tidy.
But did you know Howard?
Not really. He seemed kind of austere. I don't know. Didn't seem that. I don't remember ever having any conversation with him.
And what about the mother?
Well, of course, Margaret was gone. I had met her at one time years ago, and she was a very pleasant lady. I remember a story my husband used to tell when he was a little boy. He used to set traps out here on the hill, and he'd catch moles. And then he would tan them and dry them. and whatever happens to them. So anyway, at one time he decided that he wanted his mother to have a little cape. So he took all these moleskins and had them made into a little cape. And he said his mother was the most elegant lady he ever saw, wearing this little little cape.
So Thurlow did not continue the iris business?
No, he really didn't like it. So he had this law degree. So in 47, he opened a real estate company on Canyon Road called Canyon Road Realty. And he loved the real estate business, but he wanted to be the first lawyer in Beaverton. So he had someone come in to manage. And then he also became Justice of the Peace. And, of course, he plotted land, and he was active in Kiwanians. As a lawyer, he was very well thought of because he was quite an honest man, of course. In those days, there wasn't much money to be made. He was new, too. He wanted to buy a Cadillac very much, but he decided he wouldn't buy a Cadillac because it wouldn't look good for a young man that just established a law office to have a Cadillac. And he used to make out wills for $5 in those days. In fact, he used to have big signs on his, or fair signs on his window encouraging people to make a will.
Where was his office room?
Two places. It was where the Ramsey travel office is now, and then the other one was around on the other side, which was next to the post office, which was in the middle of that block there. It was real funny, though. In that first office, he had a little stove, a little wood stove. And one day he went to work, and it was no longer in the office. Somebody had taken it. So we asked around at a few people, and they said no, they didn't know. So finally, Harry Antrobus, a plumber, came by, who was also an active Kiwanian. He says, you know, Weed, I found your stove for you. Thurlow says, where is it? Well, it seems as though this Catholic lady in town, a Catholic lady, who lived around town for many years and had owned little apartments and little buildings, she decided she wanted that stove, so she just went over and took it one day. So I don't know whether he ever went to get it again or whether he just let her keep it, but we thought that was kind of odd. To help yourself to a stove that didn't belong to you. Isn't that funny?
What were your activities in the Beaverton area as the wife of the Beaverton's first lawyer?
Yeah, well, I liked the social life. We were quite, of course, I had the children, but of course, I had the perfect setup because Thurlow and I were married for 8 years, and the little brown cabin, there was a couple who lived there. And I was all for renting it, and my husband said, no, honey, you've got the poor children. We better get you some help. So they would get free rent, and for 2 hours in the morning, she would come over and do the housework. And in the afternoon, she'd come over, iron, or babysit at night, and then we would always give them extra money because she really helped a lot. So actually, I was the envy of all the girls in the neighborhood because I had help, and yet when 2 hours later, they'd go home, you see. So that really worked out fine. And then we were fairly, having been in Beaverton for a long time, he knew, quite a few of the old people. And then, of course, the older residents. And then, of course, in 46, there were people who came back, like Dr. Sorensen, not came back, they came to Beaverton. It was, at that time, it was just kind of a country town. I guess the wood sidewalks were gone, but anyway, Dr. Sorensen, Dr. Hansen, my own Dr. Thompson, Dr. Kane, and this was kind of our social group because we were the professional people and we used to be invited out to Portland Golf, which I thought was real special. And I played bridge, at which I was very bad, and I used to get headaches from playing bridge, and I got so I told the girls not to invite me anymore because I certainly would never learn to play the game. But I guess the most fun were the picnics. We had the Kiwanis picnics, and we had the Chamber of Commerce picnics, and we had the bar picnics, and we had the real estate picnics. At that time, my husband was president of Washington County Realty, and the children were little, and we just loved to go to picnics.
Where were the picnics held?
Oh, various places. Well, I can't remember right now. Where were they held? Oh, that one time they used to be held out on the Tualatin River. There were several big picnic parks there. You go swimming in the Tualatin. Of course, no one goes swimming in the Tualatin anymore. I saw it yesterday. It's grimy and green as your stockings. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And then It was very interesting. Instead of going to church out in the area, I had lived in the country, and I decided my children should know something about the big city. So then we joined the Baptist church downtown, and my husband had never been really to church, but he sort of liked the preacher. So we every Sunday morning we'd go down the highway. So we had friends from out here and also from other parts of the city. Kind of interesting.
Who was the minister?
Dr. Ralph Walker. One day he called up and he said, "Rose, he says, we're coming to dinner Friday night." And I thought, well, guess that's all right. So I started to clean house. I started in the attic and ended up in the basement. And it was so dumb. I did all that work. And I had individual raspberry pies. And he couldn't eat the raspberry pies because they had seeds in them. Well, anyway, years later, we met them in New York City. They came to get us, and they were living there. And they had a lovely dinner for us and took us to the airport. So they were nice people.
What were Thurlow's other interests in Beaverton? Political, social?
Well, of course, they played cards every Wednesday night. They'd have the Kiwanis group.
Who were they?
Who were they? Oh, they had everyone. They had the doctors and the lawyers and the plumbers and the car salesmen. And every Wednesday night, they played cards at somebody's house. And when they used to come to my house, I had dark red draperies, and they would smoke and they would play cards. And it was a gambling thing, but I never saw the little black book. I used to wonder, you know, whether he won or lost. I never wanted to know because I was sure I didn't approve of gambling. Because my mother had always said, don't marry a gambler.
Who were some of the people?
Well, there was Dr. Kane, dentist, dead now, died in Palm Springs a few years ago. Then there was there were two plumbers that were awfully funny. They were both about 6 foot six. One was Clearwater, and the other was Harry Antrobus. They liked to play. And then who were the doctors? Dr. Sorensen. I'm not sure about Dr. Sorensen, but there was Marble Cook. Yeah, there was Marble Cook. He taught at Beaverton High School. He's living out at King City now. But anyway, they had a pretty good time.
Did Thurlow run for any political offices in Beaverton?
Of course, he was Justice of the Peace, and I think if he had lived, he'd probably gone on to. He was very politically oriented. He just was very interested in politics.
What made him run for the state senate seat?
Well, at that time there was a vacancy, and what was so funny, his name was Thurlow Weed. So he tried to improve upon his name. At that time, there had been a governor by the name of McNary, who was very well thought of or had. So he decided he would be Thurlow McNary Weed. And I guess he just lost by a few votes, but it had to do that he felt he should have the right name. He was always figuring things out, you know. In fact, he had a, when you invent something. Oh, he had a patent attorney in Washington, D.C., because he was always inventing things. He thought that you should be able to eat cornflakes that had been coated with sugar, say. Well, by the time he got around to that, somebody else had thought of it. And the thing that really upset him was the bag boy, because he had it all figured out that you shouldn't have to carry your bag, you should be able to push it. And by the time he got that on the market, somebody else had figured that out. So that was funny. He's always thinking, figuring, doing something. Nice man. Well, I think what I liked about him, because he really liked me and all that, that helps, you know.
And what about the real estate business?
He liked it a lot, and he was good at it. This was 47, I guess. We had the corner, it was down here in the office. That was before you came. And he decided it was not close enough to town. People would call up on the phone, and they'd say, well, we'd like to move out in the country, but we don't want to move any further out than Ben's Park. It was about 47, so he moved. He always felt that if you came out Canyon Road, that people who came out in the country would stop at the first real estate company. So at that time, he built a small building, and he had it up near, right below Ben's Park there on the right-hand side. And he felt he was getting a little bit more business because more people stopped there to buy. And I never liked his working on Sunday, but he kept telling me that Sunday was when the people were out looking at real estate. So I'd sit in the houses in the afternoon and be nice to people.
Now, were these houses that he built or houses that he sold?
No, there were houses. And there weren't. I remember the very first house he sold was over there. I pass it every once in a while. No, there were houses that people, there weren't that many houses, many new houses I remember, because they hadn't built Cedar Hills yet. These were just houses that had been sitting around. I forget the prices on them, but he would tell me about the houses. I'd have to come look, and I'd tell me about the size of the rooms, how people liked certain size rooms. And then I'd just talk to them about, you know, the convenience of the kitchen. So we had kind of a fun thing going.
What was this neighborhood like then?
What was the neighborhood like? Well, I just know I had a little four-year-old boy, and he didn't have any playmates. And Ricky Hallambo lived across the street on Canyon Road, and those little boys used to cross Canyon Road to go visit each other. And the mothers, we just knew they could cross the road by themselves. And about the time Ron went to school, Thurlow had some steps made down on, so instead of having to go all the way around, why, Ron could walk down the steps and take the school bus. Well, there wasn't anyone around. The Underwoods were down here, and I was living in the little house. The babies were little, and there wasn't anyone around. And so I figured that I would have to get acquainted with people. So what I did, I'd put the two children in the wagon with a box of graham crackers and a bottle of milk, and we would walk all over the Beaverton area. I mean, like, Bertha Beaverton Highway. Every morning for about 3 hours, we would walk. So I remember the very first lady I met that I still see. We were not real close friends. She lived over there across on the highway there, and she was out in the yard. And I said, you know, I'm new in the area. She said, well, I haven't been here too long myself, but I've got a big pot of soup on the stove. Would you like to come in and have a cup of soup with me? So that was about the first woman I met.
Who was she, Rose?
Everoons.
Where did they live?
Well, they finally sold their little old house, and they have kind of a really nice place over here off of Walker Road, which I see is on the market now. And
this is a continuation of an interview with Rose Weed Thompson for the Beaverton Oral History Project. This is tape 2, side 1. The interviewer is Shirley Tanzer. The date is July 29th, 1982.
What were Thurlow's political ideas?
Well, I just remember the night he proposed to me. I had just gotten my citizenship papers, and he said to me, are you a Republican or Democrat? And I said, I don't know. He says, well, you're a Republican then, because I'm a Republican. So, as long as I don't think he'd have married me if I hadn't been a Republican. Because he was very sure that was, you know, the right thing to be. And what else about politics?
Well, did these political ideas propel him into political life in Beaverton?
Well, I don't know why he was so interested. I know that he would have gone further as far as politics. I think it was very interesting, though, when he opened up the law office in Beaverton. You see, at that time there were no lawyers in Beaverton. And not many doctors or lawyers, because you would go to Portland, even for your pansy plants that I bought and put in the little window box over there. I'd take the bus and went down to 5th and Yamhill to buy my pansy plants. And so at that time, there were about two doctors in town and one dentist. So most of the people would go to the county seat, which was Hillsborough. And I remember the first year after he opened his office, of course, he would have to go to the library in Hillsborough. It was very easy for me to go with him because I always had someone to watch the children. But he would go out there, and after about a year, he said, you know, Rose, I think I made a mistake. He said, if I would do it again, he said, I would open a law office in Hillsborough. In other words, it was still previous in the minds of people. They still felt they should go to the county seat or to Portland for an attorney. Most of the people in Washington County were at that time. There were two old attorneys. One was Tongue and one was Hare, and they were very well thought of. They were very clever men.
What was the social structure in Beaverton at the time?
Well, in 46, or like I say, the professional people really banded together. It was almost snobbish. I enjoyed it because my husband was a lawyer. And I always felt that I didn't maybe have the education of some of the other women. But that didn't bother me as much because I thought the women and I really had enough in common. I think I just felt badly that my bridge was a little bit better. But I always felt that I was a little artistic, and pretty enough. My clothes were nice, and I made a lot of the things, but I always felt that the women kind of liked me. And I had pretty well brought up babies, and
but what about the people who were not in this in group?
Well, like I said, it was kind of a snob thing, because the rest of them just weren't in it, and I suppose they formed their own groups. I mean,
who were they?
Well, who would they be? It would be shopkeepers that had been here for a while that knew each other that way, probably knew each other through the church in the old Bethel Congregational Church in Beaverton, the old Christian church. One time they had a tavern in town where the Justice of the Peace was also the tavern owner. Everybody thought that was awfully funny.
Who was that?
A man by the name of George Thine. And then, of course, the Bensons, they were Swedish. And they owned the grocery store, and when I was a little girl, 9 years old, I used to go in there, and he'd always give me a weenie, and I thought that was very nice. Then I would go over to Rexall, Dean's drugstore. Mr. Dean was still alive. And Mama would go to the doctor who was upstairs, Dr. C. E. Mason. You know, he delivered about almost 4,000 babies here in Washington County. They have a school after him. And so I go into Dean's drugstore, and they had little samples of face powder about as big as a 50-cent piece, real powder in them. And then someone told me, if I'd go out and pull the fuzz off a thistle, that I would end up with a little powder puff. So I was 10, and I thought that was really nice to have my own little can of powder and my little powder puff.
What was the role of women in this society group in Beaverton?
Oh, take care of the children and prepare nice meals and have guests come to dinner and go to church picnics, I guess, and... And, of course, I was going to night school. See, this thing of not having gone to college, I went to night school for at least 20 years to learn, you know. I remember there was a class in woodworking in Beaverton, and I thought I would like to learn woodworking. So my husband always seemed to go along, just like my husband, pretty much what I wanted to do. So I had an old bed, so he put it in the back of the car and took it down to the woodworking class. And at that time, there was John Storrs in there. Do you remember him? He was in the class. And Barnyard and Kinney, you know, the fellows that do the building, they were high school teachers at that time. And I learned to use all the machines, and I made some tables, and I made some sewing boxes. I just had a wonderful time. So I don't know what the other women did reading. Remember, they sewed a little. Yeah, I guess we used to sew a little bit, sew for our children.
Did any of the women work?
No. No one I knew worked. No, I guess they really, I mean, when I showed real estate on Sunday afternoon, that was, you know, accepted, I guess. I don't remember. Well, they had some of the women in the banks, of course. I think maybe that's what some of the women did. They worked in the banks. And I don't know, I suppose the women without husbands worked at Myron Frank, an awful lot of women worked at Myron Frank.
But in your own social group, Rose, were there any women who were renegades?
I can't remember anybody. I guess it was after the war, and everybody was just so glad to be home and have a home. And, of course, the thing to do was to have babies. And, of course, I'd always wanted 4 babies. So most of us the ones that were married to professional men had 4 babies. And my husband said, you know, I said, they get better looking and smarter all the time. He says, yeah, that could go on forever, but this is it. But anyway, Dr. Kane, who was a dentist, and I was making quite a bit of money, we thought, and Dr. Hansen, they decided to have 6 children. So, well, they always figured they were a little richer than we were. So that was kind of fun.
The babies were born in what years?
45, 47, 49, those years. Probably close together. I had 4 under 6 one year. And the Iris office, which was the Iris office for many years, had been turned into a nursery. I had farm paper, little pink pigs, and haystacks, and linoleum on the floor, and a little fence with a little scallop over the top so the children could see Mama work. And I had them all in the corner. I had all 4 of them in the corner there where I could watch them. I always enjoyed my children a lot.
Yeah, what was the determination to have 4 children? Did you ever talk about that?
No, I always wanted lots of children. 4 just seemed at that time. Well, I had a thing of, I think at that time after the war, it was a thing of being able to afford them. If you could afford, have afford children, you had four children, you could afford them. Two children never seemed like very much.
Tell me about Thurlow's illness.
Yes, that was very sad. One Sunday afternoon in 52, we were driving out to Hillsboro, and we had a nice, almost a new car. He never felt he could have that Cadillac as long as he was a young lawyer. But we had a nice car, and we drove along the highway, and all of a sudden, he all but stopped the car, and he started going into a terrible shaking type of thing. And I thought, if this isn't a heart attack, we're really in for something. So he went to the hospital, and they just diagnosed it as food poisoning. So a couple of weeks later, it happened again. He fell out of bed in the back room. And so the doctor said he better start having tests. So we went to Good Samaritan, and they tested him, and they said, well, he's got something in his head, and it's probably a tumor. So then we were waiting for Dr. Raff at that time. I think he's still around Portland. He was considered one of the 10 best brain surgeons in the world, and we would have to wait several weeks for him to come back. So Earl, wherever he was, so Sunday night we checked in. So Monday morning, they located the tumor in his head. They'd shaved his head. So they turned to me, and they said, Mrs. Weed, shall we operate? And I said, why do I have to make the decision? And they said, well, you're next in the family. And I said, and if you don't operate on him, they said, well, whatever it is in his head will eventually kill him. So I said, well, go ahead and operate. So here I was all by myself. Kids were well taken care of, and I was downtown on the, walking out and having a cup of, who didn't drink that much coffee in those days? What? Maybe a cup of tea or something. So 7 hours later, he was still in surgery. So everybody said, now, nurses said, well, you know, it's probably not malignant, or, you know, he... But it would have just sewn him back up. So he did come out, and Dr. Raff said it was a capsulated abscess, that it was not malignant. So it was a big horseshoe cut, and he had brain infection, and he had bone infection, and he was in the hospital for weeks. At that time, there was a bus strike, and I couldn't drive a car. But through some of my friends in Beaverton, I was in town every single day to see my husband. 7 weeks later, he came home, 40 pounds thinner, but feeling fine, went back to work at the office. And I'd learned to drive the car by then. And we were taking the children out to Forest Grove. That's the only place where they'd get swimming lessons at that time. This was about 49. No, no, it was later than that. 52. And I still wasn't driving. So anyway, they all learned to swim. And that made me feel better because they were crazy about water. And but this was September, October, November. So in February, he and I both had the flu, and we were just awfully sick. So finally, I got well, and he just didn't seem to get very well, and he had a funny gray blister under his nose. So I said, honey, you better go have that checked. I don't know what that is. So it was diagnosed as cancer, and 45 years old. So he was a Good Samaritan, so I said, well, honey, I don't know what this illness is. You may have to have an operation. I said, why don't you move to the Veterans Hospital, because he was a veteran, and I thought if the expenses were high, that'd be the best place for him. So he moved up there, and they said it had gone down into esophagus, and they said, well, I just assumed they could operate. I thought nothing of it. Everybody says, well, they do wonderful things now, and so forth. So I was out in the hall there at the Veterans Hospital, and the chaplain came out, and he said, Miss Weed, I want to talk to you. And he said, you know, I don't know whether you know it or not, but your husband's very ill, and he will live less than 6 months. So here I am by myself. Seems like a lot of time in my life I've been by myself. And so I went on in and started talking to him. I guess I was pale or didn't say much. He said, you've been talking to somebody? And I said, yes, I was talking to the chaplain. He said, I'm really sick, am I not? And I said, well, he said, I have cancer and they can't operate on me. And I said, I don't know, I suppose today I would have lied about it. I don't know. And I said, well, yes, you are sick. So anyway, the doctor said that he would be dead in less than 6 months. It made me very angry because I thought, well, who are they, God, that tell me when my husband's going to die? But he lived only 3 months. And he did come home, and he was never in bed, except every morning he'd get out of bed, and he'd be 5 pounds thinner, and I took him up to St. Vincent's Hospital. By this time I could drive, and he'd have the treatments, and he'd come back, and he'd be sick all night long. So anyway, the last month, a woman came by, and she said, there's a faith healer down in Ashland. Why don't you go down to see her? And when you're that sick, you know, you just... So I went down there. And I went to Ashland, and in the cab, I was in a cab with a man from the Medford Airport, and I turned to him, and I said, I'm Rose Weed. He said, I'm Earl Wilson, I'm your neighbor. It was so funny. I met him in the same cab down in Medford. I thought that was kind of an amusing thing. But anyway, I did go to Ashland, and I found this woman, Susie, and she was from the Deep South, and there were quite a few people around in Ashland who came to this woman from all over the United States because of the healing, you know, the hands and the prayer. So every night at 9 o'clock we'd go up there, and she wore a little apron, and you put a dollar in her pocket, and she would say a little prayer. And so we were down there by ourselves, and so finally Greg was five. I knew I had to be strong. I knew his death was coming, but I had to be strong. So Greg was down there with me, and Thurlow was angry because he says, well, you'll have your children for a long time, but you won't have me very long. But anyway, he did go into a coma type of thing, went to the hospital there, and I tried to figure out how to get him home because it was that many miles away. So I called a friend of mine who had a private license plane, so he came down in the plane, took him to St. Vincent's Hospital. That was on Saturday. He finally said, Rose, I want to go home, because he said, I'm not getting any better. So anyway, I came Saturday and went to the hospital. And so I spent Saturday evening with him and all day Sunday. And in the meantime, of course, this thing had been burned out, and he had a tape over the top. And Monday morning at 9 o'clock, he called me to tell me he had died.
How old were the children then, Rose?
4 and a half, 5 and a half, 9 and 11. So I knew I had to do it. I'd never had a checking account, and a lot of things I didn't know. I didn't know anything. However, my husband did talk to me a lot about real estate. I learned a great deal about real estate, so I've been able to make money in real estate by buying small houses and selling them. So I've been fairly successful the last few years in doing this. And there really wasn't anyone to turn to. We had our friends at church, and everybody says, oh, don't worry about Rosie. She's smart enough. She'll figure it out. And I'd go to some of his law friends, and they'd say, well, Rose, there are three things you can do. You can make up your mind. What do you want to do? So, of course, I learned to think, and I found I could think and could figure things out. A few years ago, I finally met a retired judge from Hillsborough, and he said, Rose, I told you, if you ever needed help, you should come to me. Well, I'd forgotten all about him, I guess, but he would have been a good person to go to. So through the years, it's been fine. I've made one kind of bad mistake in real estate. I sold this property down here, Shirley. And remember where the apartments are, and I sold it, and I should have kept about 100 feet, which had been part of the service station, so, because I am, but anyway, that was about the only mistake I made. It was probably a difference of a couple $100 a month in income, which would...
But Thurlow had made some arrangements for the way the land was to be sold, and...
Well, he left the house and the real estate in life estate for the children through the bank. In other words, I could never sell, but I could rent it. I wouldn't have to live in it, which was a very excellent idea. Because I think I would have probably sold it half a dozen times, you know, when I was off to Europe or Hawaii. The service station at that time wasn't doing very well, but of course it provided money for the children at college, and now things are going better, and I get a couple nice checks a year, and that helps. The land was all platted, but there wasn't as much money as people thought. Everybody thought, well, I was very rich. He had a $10,000 insurance policy, and there had been a mortgage on this house for $10,000, which I didn't know about. So I immediately had to have that paid off. So then there was some money from selling the real estate company. Well, yeah, there were some law books sold. And there was some money in the bank. And I had enough money to go out and buy a new Pontiac and
pay for our... Did he have property in Beaverton?
Only here.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. He had looked at property at Beaverton several times, but he never really had that much money either, you see. He had just come back from the war. He had the land. He was trying to get established in business. He had a wife and four children. Never really had that much. And I remember when he was sick, I said, you know, Thurlow, I wonder if I'm going to have enough money to take care of my children. He said, Rosie, you'll always have money. He said, I don't worry about you. You'll figure it out. Which, you know, worked out pretty well.
Do you still keep the contact, the Beaverton contacts that you had?
It's been a lot of years, Shirley, you know. Went by to see Helen Hansen the other day. They've sold their place out there across from Barnes School. And maybe you know him. He's one of the doctors down at Damish now, Vern Hansen. So I lost track of them. And, of course, Dr. Kane and his wife are both dead. I don't see them anymore.
But you used to go out to the Elsie Stir Center.
Oh, yes. I was there this morning, and I had to find out about Nita, and I had to drink a cup of coffee, and I brought Chances on a Quilt, and I brought a cute little book. I go down there, and I see some of the, I saw Mary Gordon out there, she's an old-time teacher, and some of those people, you know, are in their 80s, and they're still so bright and so nice, lots of, very nice.
What did you learn?
Oh, I learned many things. I learned that I could think, and there were people I could ask. In fact, people used to say, Rose is always asking for advice, and then she does as she pleases. And I'd say, well, you know, it's like putting things into a sifter. You put all the good stuff in, and then when you sift it, then you pick out what you think is going to work for you. And I saw businessmen, people that I talked to who made mistakes, and I decided some of them weren't very smart about some things, and I felt that I prayed a lot, and I think that I was just very fortunate in my business dealings and very fortunate with my children and very happy in the neighborhood with friends like Shirley.
Have you had problems as a businesswoman?
No, I think the important thing for a woman alone, she should have a good attorney, someone she can depend on. And I did have a good attorney in Aloha. She was a woman that graduated from Lamet. And a friend of my husband's, and at first I was very annoyed that I should have a woman attorney, because I think the women in law, they don't seem to think right straight through a problem. They seem to go around in a circle, and it used to bother me, and I used to wish I had a man attorney because I liked his thinking better. But she was kind of a mother, and she would spend a lot of time explaining things to me. And hope's gone now, but I've always been grateful to her because she had the time to talk to me and explain things to me.
Oh, this was Hope
Bassett.
Bassett. She was one of the first.
She was the first woman attorney that I'd ever known, and she was in Aloha. She was declared legally blind about 7-8 years ago, but she was still in business. I mean, her son would take her to work and come and get her, and she had a secretary. She was kind of a little mother hen.
Is that Rosanna's mother-in-law?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And she had the two grandchildren that became Miss Oregon's.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know Rosanna.
Well, I taught with Rosanna.
Well, of course.
Mountain View. Yeah.
Yes. Well, her mother was quite remarkable. She graduated from Willamette and was a single, a divorced lady for many years and reared those three children. Quite a remarkable woman. But like I said, I was very annoyed at first because I'd go out to see her, and I'd be there all afternoon, you know, and I wanted to get the problem solved and get out. But then we'd go through this, and she'd explain this to me. She was very kind to me.
And you've done a considerable amount of traveling, Rose.
Mm-hmm.
But you've always come back to Beaverton.
Right. Well, I did it because I felt, well, of course, I had the house. But I always did it because I felt, I didn't know what I was doing to my children, uprooting them the way I did, but I felt as long as they had a home to come back to, and the weed name, that they would be secure, because they really didn't have a father, and the brother-in-laws didn't seem to. They had families of their own. So.
Now, who are the brother-in-laws?
Oh, my sister's husbands. I don't know. I think my children have survived all right in their traveling. I used to talk to the teachers at the school, and I'd say, well, what am I doing to my children, taking them to Switzerland and Hawaii and Mexico? And they'd say, well, only you as a mother would know, because at that time, the only people who ever did any of that type of thing were people who were in the services. And of course, at that time, we had very few people come in from out of state. I remember in 47, there was a fellow from California that wanted a job, and my husband said, well, why did you leave California? And he didn't hire him because he thought, well, I can't be having problems in California because no one would ever leave California.
How do the children reflect now upon the travels and the opportunities they had?
I think they enjoy talking about it. I sometimes think that my daughter does not like to travel, and of course I took her to Europe several years ago because I wanted her to be the link between my family and Switzerland. But she doesn't want to go anyplace. She loves Beaverton and she loves Portland, and I don't know whether she was... Of course, the children, all four children had each other, and they played games, and they played chess, and they played checkers, and they read, and they got books from the library. But I don't think any of them really want to do much traveling. They seem to have been there, I guess.
How did they get along now as siblings?
Very well. It's very interesting. I've really tried very hard to, of course, that they be good friends. I remember I was on a trip in California this winter, and I came home, and all four of them had been out to dinner. They'd been down to Beef and Brew, and they came back and had a glass of wine. Bonnie and Greg seemed to be close, and then Ron, who's the oldest, and Mark. Brother Ron thinks he's kind of big brother. Of course, he left when he was 18. You know, I don't think he was. But he spent a lot of years helping me. I sometimes think I couldn't have done it without Ron, and maybe it was kind of hard on Ron being the oldest. I really think I expected too much of him as I look back. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons he went to live in San Antonio, Texas. He said to me one day, he said, you know, Mother, you gave me a lot of responsibility. And I said, yes, but I didn't think I'd give you any more responsibility than you can handle. But I think as a 12, 13-year-old, 14-year-old, I think maybe I expected maybe companion, not I didn't spend them, but I needed his help because I trusted him. I remember after Thurlow died, I'd bought a fur stole, which was Hope's idea, that I buy a fur stole. She said, you don't have a fur coat, and I said, fur coats were very important, and I said, well, if anything I wanted was a mink stole. Well, that to me was like asking for the sun to drop out of the sky. So anyway, I did buy a mink stole, and it was $1,100, which was a lot of money, and I hid it under the bed. So Ron came home one day, and he said, Mother, he said, I found a fur wrap under the bed, and if it's mink, which I think it is, you take it back because we can't afford it. 12-year-old.
Did you take it back?
No, I kept it. I loved it.